Hi, McCartney fans, and welcome to episode 108 of Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. We are a Paul McCartney talk show mainly dealing with the solo career of Paul McCartney. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Tom Hunyadi, and you may know me from my other show, Talk More Talk. And I am joined by my partner in crime, my backwards traveler. He is Andy Nichols. Andy, how are you?
Fully restored with power and happy.
Fully restored with power. Very good. Very good. I'm glad to hear that. You look like you're alive again. You were hurting there for a couple days, huh?
Yeah. I'm alive again and have power and
power.
the world is soldiering on, and you carried the interview with Dave Maddox, so thank you for that, and happy to be back with a veteran of Two Legs here.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So our guest today, as you can see, he is the author of two books and another one coming up, and we're talking about Paul McCartney After the Beatles, A Musical Appreciation, Volume 1, Volume 2, and we're going to be talking about his upcoming book here today on the show. And he is Adrian Allen. Adrian, welcome back to the show. How's it going?
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me back. It's been a pleasure to talk about it.
Cool. Right on. Before we get that, we're going to talk briefly. We're celebrating 100 years of Rupert the Bear. 100 years. Wow. Amazing stuff. So we know Andy and I, our picture discs, they've been sent. They've been shipped. When this gets posted on Saturday, who knows if we'll have them by then or not. Hopefully we do. Hopefully we will. But by then also the 4K restored 4K premiere of the animated short Rupert the Bear, or Rupert the Frog, Rupert and the Frog song, I should say, will be premiering on YouTube. And that is today. And what is today? Today is the 8th. So you can check that out. And by the time this is posted, hopefully everybody has already seen it. So, you know, Adrian, my question is to you. I mean, have you been a Rupert fan, or is this something you read when you were growing up?
I don't know if it's an American thing, really. Is it mainly a British thing?
But
what it was is it used to be a daily strip in the Daily Mail or Daily Express. But I think mainly children remember it from getting the annuals, which were like full colour comics. But rather than speech bubbles, it would have the writing underneath. And I have still got quite a few Rupert's annuals, which I've passed on to my children. So, yeah, it's like a thing that you used to get on Christmas Day. You used to open your presents and get a Rupert annual as well. And I can understand why Paul McCartney was so enchanted by it, because they are great stories for children.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, he brought the rights, and obviously he was a fan enough to put, you know, his money into projects like, you know, this animated short and, you know,
long-standing ties with the Rupert storyline going back to the late stages of Wings, doing the whole soundtrack and all that stuff.
Yeah, well, even in the early stages of Wings too, with the, you know, When the Wind is Blowing, you know, stuff like that, you know, that was supposed to be for an early version of Rupert. So yeah, he's got a long history of you know, trying to get something out there, you know, for Rupert, which finally came to fruition in 84, because that was shown before the Give My Regards to Broad Street film, right?
Yeah, I believe it also won a BAFTA, didn't it too, Adrian?
I think it did, but it was actually recorded in 1980, I think, so it's quite a long gap between the recording of it with George Martin when it was put out. It was surprisingly long. Maybe they had to wait until the animation was made as well. Mm-hmm. And those, you know, he recorded the soundtrack with the last members of Wings in that thing called Spirits of Ranachan, which is the mobile recording unit at Mullough Kintyre. He recorded that bootleg album, which we Rupert the Bear demos, in one day, I think, in 1979, I think it was. Yeah, so we recorded those, but all of those songs didn't get, nothing really happened to those, and the public really don't know about them.
Right.
Some nice songs on that as well.
Right, right. And that's the first thing that George Martin and Paul McCartney worked on was Rupert and the Frog song. So,
well, after Live and Let Die, you mean?
Thank you. Yes, after Live and Let Die, with their renewed collaboration or partnership or whatever you want to call it. So that was,
I mean, could have just put in there, you remember he did the orchestration for Uncle Albert as well in 1971, but famously, he wasn't credited for it. So only when the box sets came out did we know that that George Martin actually done the orchestration for Uncle Albert's.
That's easy. That's why it's easy to forget about, because he wasn't really credited on there.
Right. Yeah. The Rupert phenomenon in this country is interesting, because I think most people probably know about it through the association with McCartney, not so much as a growing up as a part of the culture, which is in the UK. So, but I think there's enough fans of that animation and the song. I mean, it might be, some people might call it schmaltzy or whatever, but you know, I've always thoroughly enjoyed it, and it's nice to see that it's celebrated here 100 years later, and a reissue of the picture disc, which is going to be really cool to get, which some people have already gotten, I think, too.
Was it a big hit in America? It's actually the biggest selling VHS video in the whole of the 1980s in Britain. Along with Oriental Nightfish and Seaside Woman on the same one. It was the biggest VHS selling thing, which is amazing for just a 15-minute video or whatever it is.
I read there's a little controversy in that because of the fact that there's a little nudity in Oriental Nightfish.
it's very tame, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, Mac, always pushing those boundaries.
Yes, yeah, you gotta love him for that, huh? So, the picture disc is an exact replica of the original 84, which was not released here in the States, so only the Brits got that. So, I'm looking forward to that. It comes with a poster. So
nice packaging, you know, too, on that. Yeah, too, nice. It looks like.
Yeah, yeah. So, I'm debating on whether or not did you ever play your picture disc, Andy?
Yeah, because it wasn't sealed when I got it, when I bought it from the UK. It was open, so I've played it a handful of times over the years, but yeah.
Mm. And how did the sound? Because traditionally, picture discs aren't really that best sound quality.
That one plays okay. It really plays well. It's not bad for a 30-something-year-old record, and it was one of those ones you saw, and you were like, oh, got to have it. I think it was $10, too. It was cheap.
So did you get the Spies Like Us picture disc? As well?
No, I did not.
Because there's one for that as well.
No, I know. I just the Rupert one I liked. I think that one is it's so iconic, right? You know, and it's nice to see that it's. Looks like there's some additional photographs in the poster that comes with this reissue too. It looks like other outtakes and stuff like that. So that'll be cool to see whenever we get it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I believe it's being shipped from Michigan. So so we shall see, my friend. We shall see. So, Adrian, you know, fresh off the heels of your two volumes of Paul McCartney After the Beatles. I mean, we don't know if, you know going to be a volume three or not, but you're working on a new project now, Wings Live. So let's discuss that. So you put out the second volume of Paul McCartney After the Beatles, and now you're moving on to Wings Live. Talk about why making the switch to McCartney as a live act.
And just Wings.
Right, because it was actually one guy on who you might know called Tom Liverani. You know, his son James gave me some of the photographs, and he's like a prominent member on Facebook. He said, nobody's written a book about Wings before or the live concerts. And at first I thought, how could I do this? And I thought, it'd be far too much to write about all of Paul McCartney's live concerts, because that would take you into the 80s, 90s. So I thought, I'll restrict it to my favourite period, which is the Wings period, and I'll see what's out there, and I'll see if it's a viable project. After a while, I did find it was a viable project, and I sort of made a list of all the different sources I can use. The reason I wanted to do it as well was because I thought that I was getting a bit typecast into people thinking, oh, there's that like musical boffin who just knows about chords and chord symbols, and I wanted to show that I've also got a knowledge, quite an in-depth knowledge of the last 30 years of Paul McCartney's career, nothing to do with chords or harmony or anything. I wanted to do it from that aspect. So although there's the odd reference to notes in it, it's a lot more aimed at the general reader, and it's got more stories and anecdotes and things like that. So that's the reason I decided to have a go at it, and it is actually almost finished now. The book's almost complete.
Great news. So let's just talk about the start. I mean, okay, so you want to do this project, and like you said, you realize that it is a project that can be done. So talk about, you know, finding, you know, people, you know, the research, and, you know, where do you start? on a project.
Okay, yeah, okay. The first thing really is just finding out the dates of the tours and dates of the concerts. That's all available at Eight Arms to Hold You, which is obviously the definitive guide to
right.
the facts. Yep. At any given day, I will always have that book open as a PDF file. I'll always run through it, and I'll always credit those guys in the footnotes as well. I've never quoted from them. I'll always credit them for how thorough the research is. But I wanted to be more qualitative than just lists. So what I did is I listened to all the available audience recordings and all the available professional recordings. And there is quite a lot of out there. I'd say most concerts have been recorded. Some of them, the quality is diabolical. Only two of the university tour concerts are available as audience recordings. Most of the 1972 European tour is available as audience recordings. So one of the main starting points was the audience recordings, which I've got, and all the other recordings, which... So I've listened to all of those, and it was quite a slog trying to get through all of them. And then the other main source, really, was a video aspect as well. Now, I've got a friend who's compiled in chronological order. Everybody should have a look. The website's called BeatlesOnFilm.com, and he does it on all his individual Beatles. And he's got a website which tells you every single piece of video evidence which is available. So I'll always have that open, and I'll go through the different available video evidence you can get. Some of it's available on bootleg videos, DVDs. Some of it's available on YouTube. Some of it I've downloaded. And then the other thing, I've used a lot of evidence from newspaper reports who want to find out what reviewers thought about the concerts. So I was just telling Andy before, I subscribed to some online newspaper digital archives. I've also got free access to some because I'm doing a master's course at the same time as well. So I've got free access to a lot of newspaper archives as well. And the other thing is that some friends of mine, one guy called Roy in particular, has given me all of his scrapbooks, lent me all of his scrapbooks anyway. So I'll just show you this one here. So he's every single bit of information, every single newspaper cutting from the 70s, he's collected basically. It's very exhaustive. So he's got loads of reviews, loads of little write-ups, loads of anecdotes. So I thought, well, there's so much information here to write a book about. So I really was confident that I have enough information to write a book.
And of course, I'm sure you've quoted and sourced Jorg Peiper's book as well.
That's right. He's got a PDF version of that book, so that's always open as well on my laptop. So I'm always going in between these different sources, really. I'm listening with the headphones like I am now, listening to these audience recordings. Some of them are, as I say, terrible in quality, but it does give you an insight into what the concerts were all about.
Right. I tell you, an early gem, and it's horrible sounding, but is that first university show at Hull. I think the only source live recording of Some People Never Know from a live setting. So it's horrible quality, but from a historical aspect, it's really interesting to hear that song, which has never been performed live outside of that, on that source, which I'm sure you've heard.
Wow. Yes, I have. It's only two. It's at Nottingham, the first gig is available as well.
Right, Nottingham and Hull.
Nottingham and Hull, I think, yeah. So I've listened to those. And for the rest of that tour, I have relied on newspaper reports and other bits of... There's quite a lot of information in some of the tour programmes as well. Paul McCartney does comment on the touring experience in some of his programs, like in the 1973 tour program, he does talk about what the university tour was like. And also I've even got one guy on another Facebook page to do some translations for me, which are in from some French reviews I found as well online. And one of them was an absolutely appalling review of a concert they did in Switzerland in 72. Probably one of the worst reviews you'll ever read. But I wanted to put it in there because I didn't want to, if it was an NPL publication, everything would be all nice, wouldn't it? What superstar McCartney is. But I want to show both sides of it. That those early tours, you did get slated quite a lot. And I'm so glad that he's not very good at French, because he wouldn't want to read some of those reviews, really. You know?
No, but I think for historical purposes, it's wise to represent what was written at the time. And things, stuff like that that might be buried, you're going to be bringing to light now in your book, which is going to be great.
Yep. And even in the 1979 tours, there's a lot of reviewers. are saying, I mean, one of the worst things I thought was, I put this quote in and it says something like, at one point in the tour, at one point in the concert, a robot was wheeled onto the stage to play the backing for Goodnight Tonight. And it was, the robot's called Robbo. I don't know if you know, it was right. Like a drum machine disguised as a robot. And a woman reviewer said, that was surprising because I didn't think you could wheel out any more robots on stage than there were. You know, you're saying that the wings were so robotic, you know, but I put it in because I thought that's an interesting perspective that people have on a 1979 right. lineup, that they were robotic. And I thought, I'm not going to disguise this because it is interesting to read these bad things. But say, if it was an MPL document like Wingspan or something, you would never get the bad side of it put in at all, would you? You know?
Right. The 73, I mean, or I'm sorry, 72, the university tour. I mean, was that a hard one to research? I mean, were the track lists the same day in and day out? I mean, there was really not a lot of information on those out there, is there?
No, I just took it really from the two bootleg recordings we've got. Some reviews, which are from the, some write-ups from newspapers. And then some other accounts as well, but it's pretty obvious that they had so little material. I don't think I'd be missing anything.
Because
I said we haven't got many songs, so we're going to play this one again for you. And they even filled in with this thing called Henry's Blues as well, which is basically a blues jam in A major, and that continued into the first leg of the 72 European tour as well, which was just seemed like a bit of a filler, really. So you could tell there weren't many songs being played.
No. Yeah. Thank you, Dora. Yeah. Not too many. So they repeat stuff too, but fascinating, you know, early, you know, to listen to those things, you know, in those early, those, especially the university tour. So there's so few of those recordings out there that they, even though they are terrible, you know, people should listen to them just to see what they were, that stage, what they were doing.
I have a suspicion also that he's actually got recorded these for himself, because one of the anecdotes said that they would go back to the hotel room at night and listen back to the recording from the previous day or the same day. So I've got suspicion there's a lot more that he recorded that we don't know about. We've only got the audience tapes for it. But I don't think he'd put them out, because I think he's quite conscious about how bad the early wings were. One thing I do cover in quite a lot of detail is how bad the tuning was in a lot of these early Wings tours, and I'm going to go into some of the technical details as well about things like monitor amps. I don't know if you know about monitor amps, so they only were invented in about 1969. So if you think about it, if you don't have monitor amps, you can't hear what you're sounding like. So the early Wings tours, but you know those, they're called wedge-shaped things. You know that are facing the band, those what we call monitor amps, those wedge-shaped things.
Right.
The early Wings tours, we didn't even use monitor amps. As you see, they just have something called side fills, so they couldn't even hear themselves properly. So no wonder the quality's bad, and no wonder the tuning's sometimes bad as well.
Right. Andy, you got anything else?
Yeah, so from the university tours, I mean, breaking up the chapters of your book, I mean, you probably start with those tours as each Wings tour a dedicated chapter, I'm assuming, in your book?
It is, yeah, and also every tour is a dedicated chapter. I've also done the in-between periods as well, because I thought it would be interesting to tell this wing story from the viewpoint of the touring and the live concerts rather than the recordings. Because you think about it, most Beatles or Wings books are written from the viewpoint of the recordings, and then the tours were sidelined. Now, I've taken the opposite approach, so most of the emphasis is on the touring, and I fitted in the recording as well. So, for example, in the 1974-5 period, there wasn't any touring activity at all. This is when they went to Nashville and recorded on the Junior's Farm. All of that year, there were no concerts at all, so what I've done is I've done a chapter about how their playing developed, and I've also included as well one hand clapping as well, because I think one hand clapping, according to Jeff Brereton, although it's a studio recording, they were playing live without overdubs. So in a way, it's a representation of what Wings were performing like live, even though it's a studio. So yeah, so everything where they're not playing, it all is in between periods, are also covered as well.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to sum up this 72-73 period, because I think as time has marched on 40, 50 years now, I think a lot of fans, especially younger fans, kind of lump that period together, and rightly so, but if you actually study it as you have, and I'm sure the book will say that, there's a real progress of progression in terms of them as a live act from the first university tour to the later tours in 72, and then by 73 it's become even a bigger show. I mean, it's still growing, but from the leaps and bounds they grew as a live act from the university tours of, say, February of 72 to the live act, to the live European tour of 73, those leaps and bounds were huge in that time period.
Yeah, by the time you get to the last Newcastle recording from the 1973, what you find is that Paul McCartney used a 24-track recording on the last available concerts, because he knew by that stage that the band would be well-practiced and well-rehearsed. So the Newcastle recording from 1973 is recorded from a soundboard, and then it leaked out as an acetate bootleg in about 1990, I think. I remember buying it at the time. So that's a live in Newcastle one. I think we're even thinking about releasing that. And then, of course, the band broke up shortly afterwards. But there are a few dodgy moments even in that. I think it's in Go Now. You'll find that the first few bars start on Go Now, and Henry McCulloch plays a completely wrong chord. He's like a fret out. And Denny Lane starts laughing. He starts laughing at the fact he's made his terrible mistake, you know. So there are dodgy bits, but I mean, they've got character in them, and some people will say that one of the main themes I'm developing in the book is, what would you prefer to have, musicians who are totally professional and never made a mistake, or would you prefer musicians who sometimes show the human side and sometimes screw up a few times and make mistakes? And it's an interesting perspective to have, that sometimes when you're having perfection, sometimes you sacrifice character as well
for that. Yeah, but it's very interesting to see if history, I mean, obviously with the two members of Wings leaving, that kind of threw 74 into a little bit of a tailspin, but to see him build upon that momentum of the touring, would he have possibly come to America even sooner than 76 had things not changed? You know, it's interesting.
Yeah, and I've said to people on that Fanfology Facebook page, do you think really the first lineup of Wings would really have cut it quite the same way that Wings did in 1976. I just can't see Henry McCulloch having quite the same dynamism on stage that Jimmy McCulloch had. I just don't think he had it in him to do that. He just wasn't that sort of dynamic personality. And I think through the early Wings concerts, they were totally dogged by tuning issues. Is one thing I listen to as an amateur musician myself, or even somebody who's anybody who just has an ear for music will be able to tell some of those early recordings are totally out of tune. But I do think that by the time when Jimmy McCulloch joins, the tuning completely steps up, and he's hardly ever out of tune. And you will hear in between, if you hear any of the live recordings of Wings in concert in 76, one of the sounds you hear all the time is Jimmy McCulloch tuning with harmonics. You know, that pinky sound where somebody's tuning a guitar, even between tracks. So no matter how much of a wayward character Jimmy McCulloch might have been off stage, he was actually obsessive about getting his guitar tuned, even in the middle of concerts, you know, and that made a massive difference.
I like the fact that, you know, especially during that last tour in 73 with that original lineup, is that you're hearing all these songs that don't end up on a record, you know, or don't get released until, you know, with this box set, like, you know, a track like Best Friend or 1882, or even Seaside Woman at the time, you know, these tracks don't get released. So I imagine, you know, these people are expecting it to hear it on the next record, which, you know, if it was Red Wolf Speedway was a double album, they would have heard, but, you know, they don't get these tracks.
All the way through the 72 tour, Paul McCartney said every night, because he does say the same things every night, you notice that. Mm-hmm. Every time he played 1882, he said, this is a track from our next LP.
Right.
And even, I believe that when the provisional running order for double album for Red Rose Speedway came out, that 1882 was left off. So for some reason, that song had fallen out of favour, and I don't quite know why that was. I do think that one was particularly subject to bad tuning issues as well. And some people, it's a very strange song as well. It talks about some young boy being hung, drawn, and quartered or something. It's a very strange story.
Very macabre song. Hey, but
it is totally out of character, isn't it?
Yeah, hey, but hey, let's get that Yoko Ono double album out in 72. Let's get, by all means, let's get it out. By all means, gotta have it. Gotta have it.
Not one. Not one. Two.
Two.
That's all right.
And Paul can't get a double album. Still, all these years later. That's just, it burns my ass. I'm sorry.
So you sent us the chapter on 76, and I was really impressed with the detail in there, and you're talking about, you know, you getting fan perspective, but the one thing a lot of people don't realize was that 76 was postponed for a couple of months because of Jimmy's let's say accidental hand injury.
And Paul's father's passing, right? Both reasons.
I don't think Paul's father's passing had anything to do with it, because during that short European tour, his father died just before they were about to go on. His father actually passed away, and according to some scurrilous books, Paul McCartney didn't even tell Denny Lane about it. Then I had an interview, and the interviewer said, "Are your parents still alive?" And Paul McCartney said, "No, they're both dead." And probably Denny Lane was shocked by that because he hadn't told him. But whether that's true or not, I'm not sure. That might have been
that's a fact that really needs more digging into, if anybody would ever be up to it, because Paul speaks so highly of his father. Growing up, learning, he was a fireman. Like, he speaks very, very proudly of him and has lots of fond memories about him. But then, you know, he passes away and he's in the middle of a tour, and like, he just doesn't even entertain it. Well, very, very interesting.
It might not be just out of disrespect. Some people can't confront death, can they, in their life? Some people can't face up to it. Some people are in denial. And also, if it is the issue about, is it Angie McCartney?
I was just going to say the remarriage. There was some
fallout over that. And I think eventually, I'm only quoting what's been said in other things, didn't she resell his birth certificate or something? And that totally drove a wedge between them or something. So there were fallouts from that viewpoint as well. So you'd have to know about the family and personal details. But I believe he didn't go to his father's funeral because it was during that first 1975 tour. So I don't think.
Did he pass in 75 or 76, Jim Mack?
I've been sure he passed during that first European tour.
Because the tour opened up on the 9th of September at the Gallimard.
Oh, wait a minute.
75, right?
75, okay, yeah, I know what it was. So we're talking about, you had the British tour first, and then that took you to the beginning of 1976. Then you had a short European tour at the beginning of 1976, which was like March. That was the first short European tour.
Right.
I think his father died about March or something, just right in the middle of that, or just before we're about to go on that short European tour, I believe.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's always been a fascinating side story to the whole thing. You know, McCartney coming back full circle, 76, Wings, and then, you know, his father passing away. But Tom's original point that it was delayed a little bit because of Jimmy McCulloch's, what was it, a hand injury? What was it?
It said he slipped in the bathroom. There have been other rumours it had a fight with somebody, but I asked Paul Sally about this, who you know is writing a book about Jen. He said he's asked Jimmy McCulloch's brother, and Jimmy McCulloch's brother is adamant that he slips in the bathroom, so we'll just have to take his word on that. But so it did delay the tour by a couple of months, I think, yeah.
Which, in a way, I think it, you know, not that it was going to help it sell the tour. The tour was going to sell out regardless. But I think the fact that you got the little postponement, and then Silly Love Song comes out, I mean, which is, a big, big, big number one hit here. I think that just added to the excitement to that tour. The fact that, you know, the song was so popular here in the States. But also funny you talk about, you know, because I've worked a lot of concerts, and it's funny because it was only took three trucks, you know, three big semis, and I've seen trucks where it's taken 20 to 24 semis.
But for 1976, that was probably very, you know, big.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, big production then. You know, probably the biggest of his career, even so more than 79, I would imagine.
A lot more. The 79 was self-consciously stripped back to the basics, every aspect of it. So I think I read that they had 100 people working on the 75-76 tour, and I believe there were only 40 or something like that people going on the 79 tour. It was deliberately stripped back. There were no special effects. Live and Let Die wasn't played, which Live and Let Die must have taken like a pyrotechnics expert to travel with him anyway. There were no laser beams or anything. And it wanted a back to basics approach. I think really because James had just been born, his son, and probably the more things you put in it, the more hassles and more problems you create for yourself. And he probably just thought, let's just make something hassle-free so we just go on the road without all of these special effects, because there's less problems and there's less issues, aren't there? You know?
Right, and to that point, you actually write about it very well in the chapter, the use of these lights through Shoko, which was the lighting company that kind of did all this, which kind of very famously Genesis used to kind of enhance their shows for concerts too, but nice to, like, Shoko was the lighting, you know, that was the concert lighting company. If you wanted to have a big, massive show with lights and lasers, they were the ones to use. And Paul certainly, you know, pulled out all the stops for that in that tour.
On monitors as well, I think they went around a few British people to say, talk about monitors, how important it was. Can you design as a monitor system? And none of the British people up to the job. So they had to get these guys in from Texas who actually traveled with their equipment and then stayed for the duration of the tour as well to install these monitor systems, which I believe were hanging up somewhere in the countries and facing the performers or something like that. They had some particular solution for it. So that was, it was all state-of-the-art stuff. It was basically as advanced as you could possibly get. And that's why he spent weeks and weeks rehearsing everything on a soundstage.
Elstree, right?
This big of Borehamwood in Elstree.
Yeah,
so they spent weeks just trying to synchronize it, because obviously the more effective you've got to make sure that all of the sound and the stage and the props and everything syncs together. And if one thing goes wrong, it can make everything else go wrong. And I had backdrops for Magneto and Titanium Man. And, you know, it was as elaborate as you could possibly get, wasn't it? So that's why I spent so many weeks rehearsing it.
Well, talk about like Live and Let Die being done indoors, as we talked about before we went on the show. That was really risky for back then.
It probably was, wasn't it? Yeah.
But
saying to Andy before the show that one of the amazing things you read about it was not just about the persistent smell of weed in every single concert in America that people have said, but the fact that we're letting fireworks off and firecrackers within indoor arenas like Madison Square Garden. Indoor arenas. I mean, it's surprising nobody actually died during a concert. Never mind, they got injured. I mean, the idea of letting off a firework is inside an enclosed building is absolute madness, isn't it? But that sort of crazy stuff went in. I went off during that tour, and they just thought it was excitement, you know. And one of the concerts I've talked about is the one outside Washington, D.C., which I think is Maryland, where if you actually listen to the audience tape, you've got a chance to listen to it. You can actually pick up the atmosphere. It sounds like the audience are just being crazy. You've got Denny Lane saying to the audience, can you all sort of move back a bit? Somebody's going to get hurt if you don't move back. And, you know, because in those days, like a crowd surges, it wasn't like a protective ring before they... Before where the stage was, you actually had people with their hands reaching onto the stage. It was I don't think the concept of health and safety had been developed in the 1970s. It just wasn't existent, was it?
Right.
Now, and you also talked about that too in the book briefly, just about the sequencing of where Live and Let Die was performed in terms of the show. It's a big theatrical number, lots of pyrotechnic, and then the acoustic breakdown. It's a very, 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 very astute planning with the set list on his part for that, for sure.
Yeah, they had to think about it, because what happened with the acoustic thing is they brought out some chairs, didn't they? They brought out a few chairs for them to sit down. So the best time to bring out the chairs without anybody noticing is when they're still taking a gasp of breath and there's smoke everywhere. So you can see everything's been planned to the nth detail, at the nth degree, to make sure that everything was as seamless as possible. And it really was professional, and every single comment was even repeated and on each part of the tour, you know.
Gotcha. One part of the chapter that you sent I liked very much was the fan aspect of it. So I mean, was it easy for you to get people to send their stories and pictures? I mean, did they, you know, were people excited about sending you this stuff?
Yeah, I think there were actually, I say, and a few Facebook pages just said, did anybody go to these concerts? And I did know straight away a few people went, but I seem very keen to share these stories. And what's interesting is that they always relate these stories to significant moments of a life, which just shows you how important these concerts were. They will say, there's one guy called Colin Grant, for example, who you won't have seen yet, but he went to all the British shows from 1973, I think, to 1979. And he'll say, oh, well, I met my girlfriend. And then the next one, he'll say, we were dating. And he says, oh, 1979, we were married by then. And so he's almost like relating significant parts of his life to these concerts. So you can just see how important these events were to these people. I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it, that people put these significant parts of their life and train them around going to see a Paul McCartney concert. I mean, my brother's sports mad, and he'll say things like, and it's a bit disrespectful, he'll say, oh, I remember when Grandma died, it was when United were losing against Everton in the third round of the FA Cup. You know, he'll base his recollections of significant parts of his life right. on football matches, but people in the books are relating these things like we yesterday, mm-hmm. you know, and it's really interesting to get a personal perspective, because I say in the introduction of a book, a concert is not just about the performers, it's about the performers, it's about the audience, and also about the stage crew. I really wanted to write more about them, but fortunately nobody's come forward a bit. If you think about the tremendous amount of work that goes on in putting together every single concert, and then at the end, when the audience has gone home, taking it all back down again. How many hours must it take to take all that rigging and then move on to the next place? It must be, I mean, the glamour of it must wear out after about two gigs, mustn't it, you know?
Yeah.
I see that you were...
Always fascinating when working these shows, and whenever I would get there in the morning to see, you know, see these trucks get unloaded and see how long it takes to put these stages up and, you know, stuff like that. Sometimes it took days, especially if they had to build the stage, you know, if it was an outside venue, you know. So, I mean, it's pretty interesting.
It's such an involved.
To see that process, you know, and how many people it takes, you know, I mean, it's a big ordeal for sure. But what were you going to say, Andy?
I forget.
Okay. Well, one thing while you remember, one thing I do want to talk to you about, Adrian, was
I remember.
You put a picture of what I was imagining was the cover with just Paul McCartney on there. I mean, was that still going to be the cover? And if so, are you saying that you know Wings was Paul McCartney?
Well, you can't. The thing is, there's a few different lineups of Wings. I mean, ideally, it would have been a picture of Paul, Denny and Linda. But then I had to think about what photographs were available. And then I had to think about, I can't just steal some of these photographs. So a photographer who was at one of the LA concerts, I think it was, called Dan Cuney, is very kindly, as for a small fee, allowed me to use this picture for the cover, and it's such a great photograph. I thought, I'm probably not going to find another photograph like that, or I'm probably going to have to pay so much for another photograph. And if I did have another photograph, it might be a picture of one person in it who was in the first lineup, and people are going to say, well, why didn't you include somebody on the third lineup off Wings? Why did you choose for that? So it's a bit so I've just opted for Paul. I mean, it's such a good photograph. I thought, I've got to use that, really. And
this is the photo by Dan Cuney from the Cow Palace in San Francisco.
Yes, sorry, San Francisco. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, so he's kindly offered for a small fee to let me use this photograph for the front cover. So that's the reason I opted for that, because I knew there was no way of pleasing everybody. And I just wanted an iconic and really good professional picture of Paul McCartney. Well, it has to be Paul McCartney, didn't it? And it would have been controversy, for example, if I had chosen the third lineup of Wings. So I just
how do you choose with so many different lines, you know, to represent a live thing? Unless you kind of do a thing where you get into multiple images, but then that, of course, is more fees and more money to do that. So.
It would have been. I don't think it would have had the same effect. It looks messy. I mean, Wings fans, I mean, people will read the blurb as well. I mean, most people buy my books on the internet, so they'll read, but, you know, straight away, this is a review of Paul McCartney's Wings tours throughout the 1970s, and they'll get an understanding. But, yeah, there's no way of pleasing everybody and putting all the different Wings members on one cover, is there really, you know?
Mm. Mm. doing this project, you know, a lot of people, you know, talk about, you know, it's Paul McCartney and his backing band. I mean, did you get a sense of, you know, I mean, do you feel like this was a real band while doing this project?
No, it's not really a real band, because let's face it, if Paul McCartney had left that band, they couldn't have gone out the next day and said, well, Paul McCartney's left now, we are Wings without Paul McCartney. It wouldn't have happened, would it? So if you think about that from that viewpoint, it just wasn't. And Paul McCartney made all the big business decisions as well, you can tell, to do with the contracts and who was getting paid and however. So, I mean, he made token gestures towards it being a proper band. For example, letting people sing more, have their own compositions and Wings at the Speed of Sound. But there's no doubt in my mind it was Wings and Paul McCartney, and quite a few of the early albums were credited to Paul McCartney and Wings. And then I think, was it the first one, Wings at the Speed of Sound, was possibly just Wings.
Right.
But, I mean, it's pretty obvious that if all the Wings members left without Paul McCartney, they couldn't have. If they'd have reformed Wings, nobody would have gone out to watch them, would they? I don't think.
No.
Interesting. All right. So, when can you know, fans of yours and people that would be interested to read this book, when can we expect that to be released?
Well, I'm at the point now where I'm writing about the 1979 tour. I've almost finished that. Then I've got to do a conclusion about the whole thing. But I've got to proofread it all, which is quite methodical. But if I work quickly, I hope to have it available before Christmas. Well, I'd rather have it done properly without mistakes in it than
I'll help.
Rushing it. All right. All right, thanks.
Yeah. Quick question on the publishing, and are you going to obviously self-publish through Lulu and just like the other two books?
Just like the other two, because I just think that I just like doing things my own way. Because I'm a fan as well, I'm confident I know what fans will be interested in and what sort of book I would like to read. And I just don't want, I know it sounds a bit arrogant, but I don't want people saying, oh, why have you done that? Why don't you do it my way? Well, I'm confident, really, I can produce something that I think people will be interested in doing it my way. And if I'm wrong, then people can say I'm wrong about that. But a lot of people do self-publish. And also, it's a much quicker process as well. As soon as I'm ready to publish it, it can be published. When you're doing it through a traditional publishing company, it can take a year or more for people to go through everything, you know. But it's a great sign of the times that people, if they think they've got the confidence and experience to do this, they can do it on their own. And I've got a lot of background in this because I've done about 8 other music books, so I know about how to do it and what the pitfalls are and everything. So if I wasn't confident I could do it on my own, I would do it the other route, you know.
Gotcha. Can we expect the book to be about the same dimensions as your previous books?
It's the same I've done the same dimensions, yeah.
Okay.
That's called Crown Quarto size. And I think I'm up to about page 300 now. I'm expecting it to be about 350 pages when you include the index and everything like that.
Okay, very cool, very cool.
Yeah.
And the book, it's, I mean, I'm really, I mean, there's really not a lot out there about, you know, the Wings Live, so it is pretty cool that you're taking on this event. I mean, what has been the biggest challenge for you doing this book?
Biggest challenge, really, just collecting all the evidence and all the sources, I suppose, but it wasn't that bad because there is so much there, and people have come forward. I mean, it's only the other day I was telling somebody about this book, and then somebody else came forward and gave me a load of other clippings and things. So,
And then
I've been able to integrate those as well. So, I've never found it really hard or really challenging. I mean, if I would say one thing a bit sarcastically, it's probably about, you know, listening to the 100th version of 1882 played out of tune on, you know, on a new European tour or something like that, because some of them are pretty dreadful to listen to. But I just think, for the sake of accuracy, I have listened to nearly every available recording that's out there. And it's a bit of a slog, but I'll maybe be doing something else at the same time. But something will jump out of the speakers and then it will prove it was worth listening to, you know.
Has there been a favourite tour or that you've enjoyed, you know, the most researching and listening to for the book?
There's been some favourite recordings. I just listened to that one of last night. I was listening to with the headphones one of Glasgow, the final one from the 1979 tour. I thought that was an amazing performance. Oh. And you can feel the energy of the crowd as well. I think one thing, what I really enjoy listening to recordings where you can almost feel the energy of the crowd. And there's just a few recordings where, even if the quality is not great, it's really nice to hear everybody being really involved. And also, they played in Zagreb, in what you call, what's then called Yugoslavia, now we call Croatia. Yep. And you can feel the energy of the crowd there as well. It's just, I think it's amazing to listen to these concerts where you can hear everything going well. And it's what I call a synergy between the audience and the performers. When you can hear that, even at a distance of 40 or 45 years, when you can hear that coming back through the speakers again, you know, it was a special night. And there's one guy who went to this Glasgow performance who's promised him he's going to give it from an audience's perspective as well. So he's going to write about what it was like to be there. I've just given him a nudge to remind him to write about that. So hopefully he's going to write about that. But that was an amazing concert to listen to, I think, that one.
Yeah, and that's if there's one complaint about Paul's live albums, that there's that element is taken out of just about every one of his live recordings. And that's a shame, because as you've listened to these live recordings, I just listened to this morning one of the Los Angeles shows at the end of the tour in America.
Yeah.
And there's so much banter back and forth, and kind of you'd love to hear that on an officially live album. But I guess, you know, for cleaning it up purposes, he wanted to remove all that.
I'd say that a lot of Paul McCartney's albums suffer from overproduction. If you overproduce something, you take mistakes out, but then you make them more sterile. And when I was listening to certain songs like I've Had Enough from London Town, right? I've never really liked that song, but when I heard it live without all the hand claps, because I found those hand claps a bit naff, really. When you take all of that out, it sounds like such a great track, and I do think a lot of his career has suffered from overproduction. And I think also, I was reading about Back to the Egg as well, the producer Chris Thomas said, I think in the end we overworked those tracks or something like that. And I think I've sent you a link to an early version, I think, didn't I, of Love Awake, which was recorded on that a mobile recording unit. Some amazing early takes of some of these songs, which are just... It's when you put this veneer on the top of it, or this sheen of production, it does detract from it. And I think a lot of his recordings suffer from that, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, was able to talk to Chris Thomas during a White Album Symposium back in 2018. And we talked briefly about the, you know, production of Back to the Egg, and where Paul was, you know, always changing his mind, always rethinking, you know, a track, and, you know, not being satisfied with the finished product. So, I mean, I can definitely understand what you're saying there. But the book will, when it's ready, obviously you'll be posting on various McCartney Facebook pages and whatnot, and it should be available on your website, and probably Amazon as well, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, all the major outlets, and Amazon, of course, yeah, and my website, yeah, everything, yeah.
Cool. Anything else, Andy?
No, not much. Maybe to ask Adrian about some of this collection of videos that he's been looking at and, studying, you know, over the last few months as well.
Yeah, okay. And so what happened with that is that a very good friend of mine who lives locally to me, called Roy Matthews, who you'll see on a lot of Beatles pages, was an obsessive collector of Beatles videos and everything Beatles. He gave me like a massive box of newspaper clippings. He's lent me his scrapbooks and everything. So it turned out he taped almost every single thing available on VHS video. At the time, it was broadcast, and he'd also done a lot of trading with people across Europe and even the world with these videos. So I dug up from my loft a converter from VHS to digital. So I've got a spindle here of all the things that I've converted. So I've converted loads and loads of things. Now, it must be said, a lot of them are still available in better quality somewhere else, but I've been giving these things to another collector, who's the guy who runs the Beatles on Film website. I've been uploading some to Google Drive, and he's found some things that Roy's got that nobody else has got, or they are in better quality. For example, there's something called Celebration, where it was a Granada Television in 1979 on November recorded, Paul McCartney record playing in Liverpool for that 1979 tour.
Yeah,
there was a really rubbish version that was available before then that was broadcast. Now, I've got Roy's recording that he's done because he must have had a VHS video player in 1979. He's taped off a TV and he's got a fantastic quality. So we call that an upgrade. So by putting that online, I put it on YouTube. So we've got an upgrade now of that performance. And I think they play every night and Got to Get You Into My Life. Is it Getting Closer? So we've got that now. And I'm just working my way through. I've probably only gone through half the videos of different things. And then just talking to different people as well and online and exchanging some video clips and video things. So we've even got things like The Day That John Lennon Died. His old head teacher came on the TV called Mr. Popjoy. If you've heard of him,
yeah,
he gave an interview. I've never seen that before. I've not put that one up yet. Wow. But I've got that. It's quite interesting to see his old head teacher talk about John Lennon.
And then these are just shows and interviews that have taken place over the years in the UK. Then that probably never been seen again after they've been broadcast the first time.
I don't think the BBC kept those recordings. They didn't. I don't think they saved them. They saved them now, but back then,
well,
they didn't.
I mean, there was a common practice to where they would record over stuff. Mm. You know, that's why a lot of those original Doctor Who's are missing. A lot of other recordings from BBC's, you know, are completely gone just because they would record over them.
Right.
Yeah, there is some incredibly rare stuff that is available. Jorg Piper, who wrote the book, he's got things like, I don't know if you know that Paul and Linda McCartney presented a Disney Time special in 1972, I think it was, or 73. The collectors have got a recording of that, for example. And when you've got a station masters, it means that somebody's been able to go into the studios and you'll notice it's got a time code running on it. So if you've got something with a time code, it means that it's not just being taped off air by somebody with a video player.
Right,
somehow been able to convince somebody to go into the archives and been able to get a copy from there. So there's all sorts of fascinating stuff there that really should be opened up. I mean, I believe also, I was reading last night, I know this isn't quite related, but the last Glasgow gig was actually filmed as well as recorded. You know, the one in 1979?
I think I read
last night, I think it's in Eight Arms to Hold You, but it was videoed as well as recorded. And I am convinced there's a lot of stuff that Paul McCartney's hanging on to out there that was videoed as well, but it's just in his archives. So we've got the TV regional companies in Britain got their archives that could be plundered, and then we've also got MPL's archives as well, and I'm sure he's holding on to loads of stuff. Oh, this is the other thing I wanted to say. Did you know that a film was made called Wings Over Wembley, which was a documentary made of a concert at the Empire Pool in 1976. You know, the very last concert series of the World Tour. Did you know they did? I think it was Four Nights of the Empire. Did you know that Oslo made a film of that? And they only released a 10-minute short of it, and I think it was on Wings at the Speed of Sound. You know, Wings at the Speed of Sound, I think, have some extra things. They have Wings in Venice and Wings in Wings Over Wembley.
Wings Over Wembley was a bonus.
Right, that Wings Over Wembley thing is actually just a 10-minute short taken from a longer hours documentary made of a whole concert of Wings performing on at Wembley for those last shows. So, and it's again, it's directed by, is it Barry Chattington or something like that, who did the Bruce McMill show? Is that his name, Barry? His name escapes me. I think it's Barry Chattington. He's the director. So there's a whole film of Wings Over Wembley, which is an hour long, I think. But we've only seen 10 minutes of it. So there's so much stuff out there which hasn't been released, you know.
So have you been working with, his name is Roy, you said?
Roy is the guy who lives near me, who's basically, he gave me like about four carrier bags of VHS videos.
Right.
Just get rid of them. I'm not going to do anything with them. But then I've been conversing with this guy called Chris, who runs this Beatles on Film website. I've been putting them all through him and saying, is there anything here that Roy's got which is rare, or is there anything that's junk, or any things in better quality? So I've been passing everything past him.
Right, and is there a plan? I mean, some of the stuff you've posted on your YouTube page, is the plan to share a lot of this stuff on your YouTube page, or are you not really sure because of the copyrights?
I don't think anybody's that bothered about copyrights on YouTube, because if there is a copyright issue, they'll take down, they'll block the sound on the video, or the worst thing they can do is just take the whole channel down. There's a guy who's posted lots of stuff called Adam, I think, who you've probably seen his channel before, and his whole channel was taken down because I think he put some copyright stuff on. I don't think anybody's going to be that bothered about that, but
right.
I have put some stuff on the thing. I mean, the very day after I put Ron Granada reports one of Wings playing live, somebody had taken a copy of it and put it on their own website, which did my head in a little bit. So that put me off making them all totally available. But I've got all of these. If I think of anything else which is rare, then I'll probably just share it with some friends in the future and maybe do it as a private sharing on YouTube or something like that. Yeah.
Interesting. That's really cool. I mean, you know, a lot of these things, like you said, I mean, if they've only been seen once, you know, so you're obviously you're preserving them in a digital format, and you know, hopefully we'll
start to see a few of them. And there's some really great clips out there, and some of them we've seen. I know I've seen some of the ones chronicling Paul's return back to Liverpool, doing the fundraiser for the Royal Court Theatre, which was a fundraiser show that he did for the Royal Court Theatre. And I have some friends of mine that were at that show from Liverpool.
Right.
So it's, you know, seeing, you know, BBC Merseyside and some of these reports chronicling the event, people queuing up for hours in a 1979 context is pretty interesting to look back at it. You know, that's a second generation of Beatle fans, teenagers, going to see, you know, to see it. So to watch it in that lens is always fascinating, you know, as a researcher myself. So it's always interesting to see that footage.
Gotcha. So going back to the book real quick for a minute, Adrian, are you the kind of person that has like the next project already in mind, or do you just complete this project and then think of something, you know, afterwards?
I think I've just really been focusing on this. I'll see how it goes down. I mean, there is scope then for doing Paul McCartney's other tours, like the 1989 to 1994 or whatever it was.
Right.
And then there's the scope for doing the ones after the year, was it 2002 he started touring again? But
it's such a
mammoth project, each one of those, especially if you think about the amount of available footage, which is from the 2002 one, you know, if anybody wants to listen to Hey Jude a thousand times, you know, it's amazing.
That's a...
I think you had the people who wrote Eight Arms to Hold You, didn't you? You interviewed them. One of the things is face. Doing that level of listening to every single recording of it, because it's...
Yeah.
You know.
What Chip went through, I mean, just listening to every single thing that's out there, you know, I admire him for his, you know, his patience.
You know, whereas, you know, focusing on just the 70s period, it's a lot of shoving, but like, take the 76, just American tour. What was that, 21 dates, 24 dates? I mean, that's not a lot of recordings in the grand scheme of a big project like this.
Right.
You know?
No. It depends how detailed you want to get. I mean, somebody will in the future will make a book just out of a 76 tour. But at least I've started off, because you know with Beatles books, how detailed they are. You've got like a Beatles book saying the Beatles in Wales or the Beatles in Scotland. So if you want to focus in more and more on that, but at least I think I've set the ball rolling here. At least I've got an overview of all of the tours and a reasonable amount of detail as well for the average fan. And if you want to get more obsessive and focus just on one tour, the scope for that as well.
Yeah, I think our friend Spencer is the one who's kind of zeroed in on the Beatles in series. Spencer Lee, he's quite good at that.
Oh yeah. Excellent.
So tell us about your website and you know your other two books are on there, and talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, so the website is Paul McCartney after the Beatles.com. I must admit, I was doing regular updates and that because I've been working on this book so much, I've not updated it for a couple of months now. But as soon as this book is finished, I'm going to put snippets of the book on the website and how open it up for discussion and maybe focusing on different tours and what people think about the different tours. So hopefully in the next few weeks when that book is finished, I'll start being more active on the website again.
Mm. And again, you can get both copies of or say should say both volumes of Paul McCartney After the Beatles on there, and you have hard copy or hardcover editions of these as well, right?
Some people like the hardcover editions. Yeah, I originally designed them for the softcover, but then I had to I adapted them for hardcover as well because some people just like the feel of hardcovers. Yeah, right. So you can get them hardcover or softcover. Yeah,
and you'll probably do the same thing for the new Wings live book as well.
Yeah, I'll do the same thing for that as well. Yeah,
awesome. That's
going to be a great book, and continued success to you on the two books and this one coming up as well. I think you're going to do very well with this one as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. So so make sure you guys check out the Wings Live, which will hopefully be out in December. If not, I'm sure Adrian will update us if it gets pushed back to 2021. So we look forward to having Adrian back on in the future to discuss the book after we've had time to read it. So looking forward to that. So anything else you'd like to plug before we sign off, Adrian?
No, that's fine. Just look out for the book, and it's been great talking to you.
Andy?
Thank you. No, that's it. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for all of our fans watching on YouTube and our live stuff, which Tom and I are experimenting with, our Facebook Lives and YouTube Lives. So we're going to keep doing more of that. So thank you for fans for watching those as well.
Great. Like I said, thank you to all the fans out there, especially the new ones that have been taking the time to listen to our shows. We really appreciate that. And we also appreciate all the feedback you guys give us on whether it's on email, twolegspodcast@gmail.com, whether it's on our YouTube channel, Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. Please check that out. Please subscribe to that. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Two Legs Podcast. So please check us out there as well. And everybody, thank you very much. So as always, everybody out there, have a great day and a beautiful night, and rest in peace, Alistair Beck.
Listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan Seaman.